Hello, my name is Sam Clement, and welcome to The Love of Cinema, a Picture House podcast proudly supported by Kia, powering independent cinema. And welcome to our March edition of the show. It's a big month in cinema, folks. It's the month the Oscars, the Academy Awards are announced, and it's also the month that we get our first big release of 2024 in June Part 2. More on that later in this episode. But my job, I guess, on this podcast is just to MC proceedings, to be here to guide you through our audio landscape of film chat for the next 30-40 minutes or so. As always, on The Love of Cinema, we are joined by two brand new guest film critics. Every month, we invite a couple of new sets of voices onto the podcast to share their opinions on our chosen films each show. We've got four films for you this month, including the aforementioned June Part 2. But who's going to be talking about them? Well, let me tell you. First up, we've got Eleni Jones, a wonderful film journalist and critic, also the author of a fantastic new book called Screen Deep. I'll let Ellen tell you more about that later in the show. Ellen is also co-host of the Screenshot podcast on BBC Radio 4 with Mark Kermode, a fantastic film podcast. If you're listening to this, definitely check out Screenshot. And you can see Ellen's work in The Guardian, The Independent, and many, many other publications. We are also joined by James Dyer, digital editor-in-chief of Empire. You can regularly hear his voice on the Empire podcast and the Pilot TV podcast and read his words in Empire magazine every single month. Welcome, Ellen and James, to the podcast. And on to our first film of the month, which is the long-awaited sequel to Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 1, the appropriately titled Dune Part 2. Let's hear what Ellen and James made of this mega blockbuster, the first blockbuster of 2024.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes, then great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
So, Ellen, no one needs to hear me talk about Dune more than I already do, but I'm fascinated. So are you a Dune fan? Did you like the first one? And what did you think going into this?
I really liked the first one. And what I like to tell people after I came out the first one was, it's like Star Wars, but for sexy people. Meaning that was obviously a way of complimenting myself because I liked it and I've never been that infused by Star Wars, which I know will horrify you, James, but there we go. So part two had a lot up to, and it absolutely excelled all of my expectations. Like, when the granddaddy sandworm comes, my seat was shaking with anticipation. And it wasn't just coming from me. I think it was also the incredible sound in the, you know, in the IMAX theater. And it's just such a proper cinema experience. And I even loved, like, the little, like, I tell you what I loved, maybe what excited me most about this incredibly exciting film was the sort of extreme water conservation methods of the Thremen. Like, I could watch a whole documentary going into technical mechanical detail on the ways the machines that they've made to suck water from corpses and so on. In fact, there's a bit where Zendaya's character Chani is like explaining to Timothy Chalamet's character Paul Atreides how one of these machines works, and he's like just making goo-goo eyes at her, and I'm like, listen, this is fascinating. Let's just watch that. What most excited you about this very exciting film?
I mean, look, I'm a massive Dune nerd. Like, I could talk for the next hour and a half just about the lore alone. I won't, don't worry. I mean, look, I loved the first one. The second one and the first one as well, it felt like a window into Denis Villeneuve's head. Like, he's a guy who's been obsessed with this book since he was a teenager, since he was 13 years old. And it feels like those images that we see on screen are exactly what he wanted. And I think what's so good about this film and the first one is it feels like a completely untampered with storyteller's vision. Like, there's not a hint of studio interference anywhere in this, for good and bad. And I think it makes for this singular vision and this incredible cinematic experience. My question to you, though, is that, you know, do you think that some people are going to struggle with some of the storytelling? Because, like, the first one, it's almost quite conventional in structure. You know, it feels very self-contained. You know, it has a very understandable, almost Game of Thronesian political narrative. But this gets really into the lore and the religious sort of symbology and all of this stuff. And I wondered how much people who weren't sort of attuned to that would just be like, what is going on?
Well, you're asking the right person, because I haven't read the book. But I mean, maybe there were a couple of moments. I kind of anticipated that I would get a bit lost going in. I watched like a sort of recap YouTube video just to remind myself of where we were, which I would recommend people do. It is good. But I kind of, as you say, the filmmaking's so good. It's such an immersive, incredibly well-built world that you just kind of get swept along, even if there are little bits of details that you don't remember about the plot. And I really appreciated too, like, how kind of real world geopolitics and religious politics can map onto to the ideas in the film, but not so neatly that it feels kind of pat or polemical in any way, but neatly enough that if you are the kind of person like me who likes a unified theory of everything to talk about in the pub afterwards, it's certainly there for you to find. So I love the Bene Gesserit. I really hope, there's been talk that they might make a kind of TV spin-off that's just based on the Bene Gesserit, which is this kind of shadow matriarchy sisterhood with psychic powers led by Charlotte Rampling, which I would love to see. So I hope that happens.
Yeah, I mean, the lore of this, I mean, it goes very, very deep. The book is super dense, and it's great. I'm really relieved actually you said that, because when I was watching this, I was thinking, am I overthinking this, or is this just super dense for people? But actually, maybe it is that he's made the world so appealing that stuff just kind of flows over you, and you get the stuff you need to understand. And if there's other stuff in there that's really deep cuts for people who love the books, maybe that's just not necessary, because you have these amazing set pieces, as you say. Hans Zimmer's score is absolutely bombastic, and it's brilliant. But then there's a monochrome arena fight, which kind of I thought was such an arresting visual and an introduction to Austin Butler's character. I loved it.
That scene was fantastic. And also, I want to say, hey, how about that Javier Bardem? He's very good value in this movie, isn't he? He's kind of the comic relief of the film, with this sort of very flippant, shoulder-shruggy death threats that he just issues every now and again to all and sundry. I kind of thought it reminded me a bit of Puss in Boots, actually. The most important film franchise in Hollywood today. I don't know if he's like, you know, maybe Antonio Banderas should watch his back for that role. But I thought he was fantastic. So, actually, so there's loads of these. You don't have to really know what's going on, although I think people will. I didn't find it that difficult to follow. But there's loads of little details, really great performances. There's stuff in there that you will enjoy, even if you're not entirely swept up into the Dune lore like some of us are.
Yeah, I think so. I think it has that appeal, that sort of, it crosses over more than you think, in the same way that I guess people didn't think Game of Thrones would necessarily have mass appeal because it's fantasy. But I think the themes are universal and the characters are so interesting, and I think this has that too. And Villeneuve made a really smart choice, which was to keep Rebecca Ferguson's character kind of front and center through this second story. When she kind of peters out in the book, she vanishes. And actually, she's arguably the best character of all of them. So I'm really glad that she gets so much more to do. And obviously Zendaya, who had not a lot to do in the first film, kind of comes into her own as well. So yeah, great stuff.
Well, there we have it. Our first film of the month, Dune Part 2, is in cinemas right now. And on this very podcast feed, we have a special bonus interview episode with the composer of Dune Part 2, the great Hans Zimmer. I was lucky enough to talk to Hans ahead of the world premiere of the film back in London a couple of weeks ago, and you can listen to our conversation. Please check that out. It was very much a pinch me moment. Loved talking to the great Hans Zimmer there. Moving on to our second film of the show, it's Copa 71, the story of the 1971 Women's Soccer World Cup, a tournament witnessed by record crowds that has been written out of sporting history until now. Over to Ellen and James to talk about Copa 71.
Let's go somewhere new. See worlds we've never seen before, so that we can feel inspired. Whether you're sitting in a cinema or in one of our cars, inspiration comes when we feel something new. That's why our electrified range is designed to take you on inspiring journeys. Kia, proud supporter of independent cinema.
Kia, movement that inspires.
This is unbelievable. What year was this?
1971, Mexico City. A tournament of unprecedented scale, hidden for over 50 years.
La Copa Mundial Femenina.
110,000 personnes.
Mamma mia.
C'était impressionnant.
It was euphoric. Goal! Goal! Little did we know what was to come.
What's a nice girl like you doing playing football, though?
FIFA. I don't like anything about it.
There's a lot of resistance.
No, I think that it's a good gag.
When we came back,
No bunches of flowers, nobody there to meet you.
And then we found out we got banned.
Thus, women's football is crushed.
So this is a film, a documentary, Copa 71, about something that I felt like I should have known about, but I definitely didn't know about. Was it telling you lots of things you didn't know, James?
Well, I think anyone could tell me a lot I don't know about football, because what I know about football, the sum total of it, is nothing. I know there's a ball, I know there's a field, I understand the ball has to go into the net. That's pretty much the extent of my knowledge. So the fact that there was a Women's World Cup in 1971, yes, was a surprise to me, but I guess what's a bigger surprise is that it's a surprise to everyone, right? Like, everyone, I guess, got swept up in kind of lioness fever, and the Women's World Cup is now a really big thing. But the fact that nobody seems to know that this event took place, that this Mexican World Cup took place, and, you know, England was there, and they had a team, and they call them the Lost Lionesses, which I thought was a great name for them. The fact that not only do people not remember them, but they, even the people who played, never talked about it, right? This idea that they were, you know, they weren't greeted off the plane when they returned with fanfare. Obviously, they didn't win, but nevertheless, you know, they weren't greeted with fanfare, adoration. They were just ignored, and they were almost shamed into not talking about it, almost like gaslit into thinking that it had never happened. So that kind of blew my mind. And then the idea that women's football in England was literally banned from 1921 until, I think it was 71. I genuinely almost can't process it. And obviously we're looking at this from a 2024 position, and the world is thankfully at least a little different then. But it's absolutely wild. Like, are you a football fan? Were you keyed into all this?
Same as you. I'm married to a man who's obsessed with football and persists in telling me what the scores were at the weekend, even though I'm not listening. But I personally am not interested in football. And I always think that, like, a test of a really great documentary is that it can make you interested in the subject, even if you're not interested going in. And I was a bit worried for the first, let's say, third of this, that this movie wasn't going to do it for me. But there were a couple of points where I was like, okay, you've got my attention now. One was like actually an on the pitch moment. And there are, if you're a kind of match of the day fan, there's a lot of interesting, good football sequences from like the big matches of this tournament. But there's a scene where Elena Shavo, who should be a household name, because she's an incredible footballer, when people kind of reckoned her like the best female footballer in the world at that point, an Italian national player. There's a bit where the ref, kind of, who we think is a bit biased, come on ref, moves the ball for a free kick out of the position that she wants it in, and she still scores from the free kick. And I don't know much about football, but I know an absolute legend when I see one. So that point,
and doesn't
I was
it
really
also
like,
get disallowed?
Yeah,
like, it's,
I know.
Wild.
It's,
and you're just yelling at the screen.
Yeah, it turned both of us into these wild football hooligans, didn't it? So I mean, that's got to say something for this film.
Yeah.
But also, like the as you say, like when you get towards the end of the film and you see how, you know, the tournament was a huge success. We've seen interviews with women from all over the world who were part of the national team and were hugely patriotic and were really skilled footballers and athletes. And then at the end they say, wow, well, that was great. And we knew then that like women's football would finally be put on the map, people would finally care. And you obviously, there's the kind of dramatic irony of it all, because you know that that did not happen. But also that people are saying that now about the most recent Women's World Cup. And you kind of, and it's so heartbreaking how systematically this was all shut down by the FA. And I've got to give a shout out here actually to one of the talking heads from this documentary, the historian and sports writer David Goldblatt. He's really good at good value when it comes to talking about FIFA and the various national football organisations, and how they kind of, through like official discrimination, through sort of media blackout, just really ensured, yeah, that football would be a man's thing, that men would continue to be in control, even though they could have made loads of money out of women's football. It was just this sort of attitude that you'd rather be king of a pile of ashes than share power with women. And so, yeah. But he's great, David Goldblatt. I think, you know, he's my brother. He's not my actual brother, but he's my brother in the struggle against
Your
the patriarchy.
Spiritual brother.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. I hope he's having a nice day.
It's wild, and they were coming. They were coming up with wild reasons why women couldn't play football, like medically it would be bad for them to play football. And it's just that these men in FIFA did not want to share their toys, right? Like, they just shut it down. They wouldn't acknowledge it. They did everything they could to pressure stadiums into not allowing women to play there. I mean, it's a horrific kind of institutional conspiracy to keep women out of the sport. And it's infuriating. It's absolutely maddening when you watch this.
I started to think, it's as much, you know, a World Cup of sexism as it is of football. It's almost like the individual national FAs were competing with each other to see who could discriminate against women in the most egregious and, like, absurdly self-defeating ways as well. You know, like, as you say, Mexico's team were banned from playing in accredited stadiums afterwards, and they were, you know, got all the way through to the semi-finals. You know, it's the film itself is a really interesting exploring what is, you know, the reason for the film to exist, which is that we don't know about this topic at all. How can it be that there was this huge World Cup involving women from all over the world? It was massive in the press at the time, and everyone, even women footballers themselves, have forgotten about it.
Yeah. No, it's nuts. And massive respect also to Rachel Ramsey and James Erskine, obviously the documentarians here, for constructing this in such a way that kind of combines sporting intrigue with kind of the exploration of the social justice elements to it. And so there's a little bit of both. Like, if you're there for watching a bunch of women pushing back against the patriarchy, you know, they've got you covered. But also, if you're looking for just an exciting, nail-biting sort of sporting event, that's in there too. So it's a very skillfully put together film, and frankly not something I ever would have voluntarily watched, so I'm actually very glad I saw it.
Same.
Thank you very much, James and Ellen, for that. Copa 71 is in cinemas from the 8th of March. On to our third film now. We've got a new movie from the prolific Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. His new film Monster is in cinemas on March 15th. It premiered at the Cannes Film Festival last year and has been heralded at a number of international festivals since then, but it's finally opening in the UK. And as Ellen will mention, it's the final film of composer Ryuichi Sakamoto, so definitely worth checking out on the big screen and hearing that gorgeous score through the cinema surround sound.
ちょっと子供のこと心配してきてるんだし。この先生に叩かれて息子は怪我したんです。誤解を招く点があったかと思われば。何も誤解してないんですよ。麦野湊君は星川よりって子いじめてるんですよ。開けてください。いつも麦野君を叩いたりしてます。麦野、こんな先生がいる学校に子供預けられないでしょ。お母さん、
What's that coming over the hill? Yes, it's a monster. Specifically, the new Koreeda. Are you a Koreeda fan? What did you make of this one?
Well, I'm a fan of mid-2000s indie, so I enjoyed that reference. Thank you. I haven't seen as much Koreeda as I will do now, having seen this film and been very moved by it. I had seen Broker, which is kind of the one he made in Korea from last year, and a couple of earlier ones as well. But yeah, this is it was a really weird, mysterious film in a way that I really responded to. Like, usually when you start watching a film, within the first 5 minutes at least, you kind of know who's who and what's going on. And I did know who's who, but it starts with this fire at a hostess club in the town that they're in. And then you kind of get into the story of this schoolboy and who seems to be being bullied, or is he? And his mother's trying to work out what's wrong with him. And then it's got this fascinating structure where it kind of circles back to that same inciting event, the fire, and tells it from different perspectives all the way through. And usually when that happens, I mean, the classic example of this is another Japanese film, Rashomon, the Kurosawa film, telling the same story from different perspectives. And it's obviously become a really interesting device in cinema and television, often in crime dramas. But usually with each telling and retelling and new perspective, you kind of get a bit more information and everything sort of slots into place in a sort of satisfying way. And that's not exactly how it worked here. It sort of seemed to complicate things a bit more and make things more interesting. And the sort of the mystery never quite disappeared. And I thought that was a fascinating and really compelling way to make a film. What about you?
No, I agree with you. I think the restraint here to not, and bearing obviously this is the first film that Koreeda has directed but not written in a very, very long time. But it's interesting how he sort of worked with the screenwriter here. There's a real restraint to this because you're right, he doesn't demystify it. It's the three story told three times from three different perspectives. The first one being a very frustrating, harrowing account of a mother trying to look after her son who's clearly having difficulties at school. There's a bit where he jumps out of a moving car, never ever go full Ladybird. And then this incredibly difficult conversation she has with the teacher and the principal at the school, which I thought was an incredibly staged piece, where the mother is so frustrated and, you know, she's being dismissed as emotional, but they're almost behaving like robots, like aliens. They refuse to engage with her. They refuse to acknowledge this happened. They do this weird performative apology, which involves extended bowing.
Mm.
And it gets to a point where this is not just a cultural difference. Like, this is just inhuman behavior, and she's maddened by it. So you get that. And then you kind of switch back to a much lighter telling of the story from a different perspective, which makes it feel like a very different thing. And it makes you question not only what you thought you knew from the first one, but also like what the title of the film is. Who is the monster? Is it the boy? Is it the institution? What actually is it? And then the third retelling of this story is, again, it's another genre shift. It's like three separate films. And the third one is a boyhood sort of love story, really. And each one kind of pushes different emotional buttons. And I thought it was really, really moving. Like, it kind of really sucked me in. But it's quite dense as well. Like, he's made no real attempt to kind of make it, you know, accessible, as you can imagine. Like, if it were a Hollywood film, it absolutely would be. Like, it's really dense. And a lot of the time, you are thinking, what is happening? I'm a little bit lost. I followed Dune a lot more clearly.
Yeah, but that there's a kind of pleasure in surrendering yourself to the storytelling anyway and just sort of going with it. And I think we should mention there's a third part in the real key creative collaborators behind this movie, who is the composer, Ryuichi Sakamoto, who died in last March, I believe. And he was an Oscar winner. He'd won Oscars for his scores for Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence and the Last Emperor. And I think he was quite ill at the time of the making of this film and only managed to compose a couple of sequences, but they're really powerful. One of them being the score for the final scene of the movie, which really makes it hopeful in a way that you're not quite sure where the hopeful emotions are coming from, but I think they're coming from the music in a large part. And I've got such a horror of, this is maybe not something that's PC to admit, but a horror of child actors. I just think there's
with good reason.
So often, you know, children's performances can like just stink up an otherwise good movie because, you know, and that's not the case here at all. They're not at all cloying. And it's actually really quite sweet listening to, you know, their sort of childish ramblings as they play together and their interactions. And when it needs to be emotional and exploring the ideas around homophobia and their sort of burgeoning sexual identities and stuff like that, it really gets to that as well. You know, there's an incredible scene where one of them sort of scared by the intensity of his own feelings and runs away. So, I want to just point that out. If anyone like me has a horror of films with child actors in, don't be scared. This one does it really well.
Yeah, Suya Kurokawa, who plays Minato in this, like his performance, it's so believable. I think the problem you often have with when children are written by adults is they don't sound or act like children. And I think in this, it was compelling in a way that, let's be honest, children aren't always, but also very real and believable. But yeah, it's a really, really lovely film.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, James. Ah, what a lovely conversation about this beautiful film. You have to go and see this on the big screen when it opens at Picture House Cinemas on March the 15th. On to our final film of the podcast now, coming to cinemas at the end of March. It's Robot Dreams, a Academy Award nominated animated feature from Pablo Berger. It's a beautiful, beautiful silent animated film based on a graphic novel, and I can't wait to hear what Ellen and James made of Robot Dreams.
Okay.
So the next film we're talking about is an animation. What did you make of Robot Dreams, James?
So it's an interesting one. So like Robot Dreams, you say this, I think of, you know, like Asimov or something, you know, or Philip K. Dick. Like, do androids dream of electric sheep? No, apparently they dream of earth, wind and fire, which is absolutely fine. But this is a really curious little film. So it's Pablo Berger's film, and it's based on a children's comic by Sara Varon. And it's essentially a silent animated movie about a very lonely dog, an anthropomorphized dog living in 80s New York, who gets a mail order friend in the form of a robot called, imaginatively, Robot. And they hang out together. They spend a day at the beach. They swim in the sea. They're living their absolute best lives until Robot gets rusty and is stuck on the beach and are basically abandoned there for reasons. And so then Robot spins out and has these wonderful, vivid, slightly psychotropic dreams of his life playing out, and it involves all kind of things. Like, there are snowmen bowling with his own head. There's an altercation with a pair of ornery anteaters. There's a troop of psychotic bunny sea scouts, you know, and a monkey with a metal detector, because of course there is. And the thing with this that works really well, I thought, was it's just lovely. Like, the emotional content is beautiful. And it's touching and it's moving and it's a real exploration, not so much of friendship, I thought, but of like mourning and grief and loneliness and a kind of yearning for connection. However, and this is where I think I might be an outlier, and I wonder whether you got on better with this, is that it is 1 hour and 40 minutes long, and it is, and I reiterate, a silent animated movie. And I feel like that's quite a lot to ask. Like, if it's a 15-minute animation, I think, you know, yeah, brilliant. Wow, this is amazing, knocked out of the park. But it's 1 hour and 40 minutes. It's quite long. Did you find it long?
Well, I'm going to counter this by telling you about the circumstances in which I watched it, because I watched this with my two kids aged 5 and 8, thinking, OK, it's an animation, so kids must love it.
Oh, dear.
I've got myself in trouble with this sort of approach before. But actually, my daughter was first like, why aren't they talking? When are they going to start talking? And I just silently, you know, carried on watching. But they really got into it. They really enjoyed it. They insisted on watching it all the way through. So I do think that the storytelling's so good that it actually doesn't matter. I was nervous too, but I totally got swept up in it. I loved the detail of the animation, like in terms of product packaging and advertising and signage and that sort of New York City of the 80s. You know, there's a scene where you see that the Twin Towers are still there, and which absolutely dates it, of course. And just those dream sequences and the emotional maturity to it as well. Like, it sounds very much like classic kids' books, kids' movies territory, you know, a friendship between an anthropomorphized dog and a robot. But there's something here, and I think it comes through the music as well, I think. It's about, like, the way you feel about exes, old relationships, and like how you can move on from an old relationship. Like, they both, when they're separated, they both end up having different relationships. And, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but there's a very kind of sweet, bittersweet, emotionally mature understanding of the significance of past relationships and past loves in it, which I really appreciated. Not sure how my 5-year-old got on with that, but but we all got something out of it. I agree with you. It's just a lovely, lovely film, beautifully animated, beautiful details, and it really made me put that Earth, Wind and Fire song, September, back on my playlist.
It's almost like an animated Brian and Charles. I guess that Robot is slightly less quirky than Charles Petrescu. But it is lovely, deeply moving. It's very interesting that your kids liked it, because I was watching this thinking, I am struggling. My attention is struggling with this. I thought kids will just go out of their mind. But maybe you're right. Maybe there's something about the honesty of the emotions in it that speaks to people.
I should say, I do have a dodgy history of just letting my kids watch films that I'm watching, because I think it's going to expand their mind, because I'm a bit of a hippie mother. So my son also watched The Man Who Fell to Earth recently with David Bowie, and is now terrified of people with red hair. So maybe don't judge me on my parenting choices.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, James. Those are our four new releases at Picture House Cinemas this March. Just to recap, we've got Dune Part 2, we've got Copa 71, we've got Monster, we've got Robot Dreams. That, my friends, is a movie marathon if ever I've heard one. All gorgeous films to see on the big screen at your local picture house. Now, whilst we had Ellen and James in our pod booth, we wanted to ask them what's on in cinemas right now that they'd recommend, and what's coming to cinemas in the coming months that they're looking forward to seeing.
All right, so what else are you excited about that's still in cinema, that's still around? What would you recommend?
There's a film called Someone's Daughter, Someone's Son, which I still haven't seen, but I have noted that it is still in cinemas and I'm desperate to catch it. It's a documentary about homelessness, and it's made by this incredibly vivacious, dynamic woman, Lorna Tucker, who I had the pleasure of seeing talking about the film recently at MK3D, one of Mark Kermode's live events at BFI, which is always a place where I pick up good viewing tips from. And what she said about it, which really inspired me, was that this is a real kind of call to action. You know, it's the descendant of Ken Loach's Kathy Come Home, in that we want this film to actually solve homelessness, because homelessness is totally solvable. So I think it's getting great reviews. It looks really powerful. And I think it's one of those films that as many people as possible should definitely see it. What about you? What are you looking forward to?
I haven't seen that, and that is actually on my list. I mean, in terms of stuff that's still out, like, I think, oh my God, it's very hard for me to pick a single one, not least of all because A, the first Dune has been reissued, but also 10 Things I Hate About You got a 25th anniversary re-release, and that is my favourite teen movie of all time, and I think it is incredible, and everyone must see it. Julia Stiles is legendary as Katharina Stratford. Obviously, it's a Shakespeare riff, but that's loads of fun. But if I'm going to pick something a little bit more recent, it would be Sean Durkin's The Iron Claw. I don't know if you've seen that one yet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And haven't stopped crying since.
Oh, my God. I remember describing to someone, I said, yeah, imagine if fighting with my family was a massive downer. And that probably gives you a kind of an idea of what the Iron Claw is. But it's about the Von Erich wrestling clan. And I kind of knew about them because I was a big WWF fan in the 80s. And Kerry Von Erich, the Texas Tornado, was a big deal. And he's in this, played by Jeremy Allen White, who's obviously amazing in The Bear. But as good as he is, and as good as Harris Dickinson is, who was also brilliant in A Murder at the End of the World, this for me is Zac Efron's film. Like, he's always been a good actor, but I think he's always struggled to just shed that High School Musical kind of like American apple pie kind of image. And in this, like, the amount of emotional heavy lifting he does is incredible. I thought he was phenomenal in this. And also there's loads of wrestling in it too. So a little bit of something for everyone. But yeah, not a laugh fest, I would say. It's pretty heavy stuff, but it's really good. Okay. So that stuff that's out right now. What are you excited about that's coming up?
So much. I could just move into the cinema and camp out there for the next 6 months, I think, and never leave. But a couple that spring to mind. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for Challengers,
yes,
which is this new kind of extremely hot, fanning myself, tennis movie starring about a sort of three-way menage a trois relationship between Josh O'Connor, Zendaya, and a third actor whose name I've shamefully forgotten. But it looks incredible. I'm a big post-Dune 2, I'm an even bigger Zendaya fan, and I can't wait to see this. I've met Josh O'Connor before, interviewed him before. He's an absolute sweetheart. So talented. I think this is going to be his year. He's having loads of interesting films out, so Challengers very much. So what about you? What are you looking forward to?
I will say, if I were naming a throttle tennis film, I'd have totally called it Three Love, but that's just me. For me, oh God, so many things, as you say. Dev Patel's directorial debut, Monkey Man, looks incredible. You've seen the trailer for that. But if I had to pick one that's a bit left field, it would be Abigail, which is Tyler Gillett and Matt Bettinelli Olpin, who did Scream 6 and Ready or Not. Their new film, which it's got Catherine Newton in it again, but it's about a child vampire ballerina and a bunch of kind of ne'er-do-well kidnappers who are locked in a house with her. And it's so utterly absurd and looks so much fun. The trailer, genuinely one of the best trailers I've seen in ages. It looks absolutely unmissable. I mean, I've got a lot of time for that kind of, for the kind of horrors which work on a base horror level, but also are very playful. Like, Ready or Not had that. Like, it had a real sense of fun to it. And I think that's been missing in a lot of horror films recently. So yeah, I'm very, very excited for Abigail.
Oh, do you think it'll have a lot of jump scares in it?
I imagine it'll have a fair few of them, but also I think it'll have some big laughs too. So I think a little bit of something for everyone there. Well, it's been lovely to talk to you about these films. Where can we find you on the interwebs?
It's been an absolute pleasure, James. Thank you. Well, I've got a book out at the moment. It's called Screen Deep, How Film and TV Can Solve Racism and Save the World. And it's on sale at any good bookstore. And it's
amazing.
I try and be, you know, hilarious about the awful topic that is racism. But it's great. I'm on social media, and I like for people to come and talk to me on social media. And especially if they've read the book and want to chat about that. I'm on Instagram at Ms. Ellen E, and on Twitter or X at Ms. Ellen E. Jones. What about you? Can we find you online?
Oh, you can, sadly, at James C. Dyer on social media. You can find me on the Pilot TV podcast every Monday and on the Empire Film podcast every Friday. And in fact, if you want to come to Norwich, Sheffield, Dublin, Salford, and actually Birmingham, which is where we are today, we're actually on a tour at the moment. We're doing an Empire podcast tour around the country. But if you
have who's a... posh?
Oh, well, exactly. It should be fun. Well, that's assuming anyone turns up. But empireonline.com/podtour. You can book tickets now. So please do, because otherwise I'm going to be dune-splaining to an empty room.
Can I also plug, I forgot, you're reminding me with your talk of your excellent podcast, which I'm a big fan of. I also want to plug my podcast, Screenshot, which is on Radio 4, 7:15 every Friday and wherever you get your podcasts. And I co-host it with the great, the noble Mark Kermode. So even if you're not a fan of the sound of my voice, I'm sure you'll love the sound of his.
Some excellent recommendations there. Thank you so much to Eleni Jones and to James Dyer for joining us for this podcast. Do check out their work in all the right places that they just mentioned at the end of the show. I can also definitely recommend checking out Ellen on Screenshot with Mark Kermode and picking up her book Screen Deep. And I'm a weekly listener to the Empire podcast, and you can hear James over there. Before we wrap up, I want to say a big thank you to you, the listener, for listening. Thank you so much. It means a lot to us for you downloading this podcast. If you enjoy the show, please do recommend it to a friend and rate and review on your podcast app of choice. If they have things such as star ratings, a 5-star rating always goes down very well indeed. And any reviews are always nice to read. So thank you very much for that. For more news of what's on at Picturehouse Cinemas, do visit picturehouses.com. For all of your listings needs, and you can follow us on social media at Picture Houses, on all of the major social networks, Instagram, Twitter, /X, Facebook, TikTok, Letterboxd as well. We're on Letterboxd now. Do give us a follow. A big thank you to Kobe at Stripped Media for producing this episode, and to Laura, as always, for editing the podcast together. Thank you both. Couldn't make the show without you. Literally couldn't make the show without you. It's hugely, hugely appreciated. And yeah, do subscribe to this feed. We have lots of mini episodes in between these monthly episodes, but we'll be back in April with 2 new critics, 4 new films to talk about, and we'll see you then. Have a good month of cinema, folks. See you next month.